From Chicago, on the north side, doing what? Getting ready to go back home. It's Ben, listening to the Gangland Wire podcast on my iPod. Talk to you later. Bye.
You're listening to Gangland Wire. True stories from the mouths of the men who either committed these crimes, investigated these crimes, or reported on the crimes. Hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins. Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. I'm going to attempt to entertain and enlighten you all by myself again tonight. I'm here in my newly created home studio. And tonight I want to do the story of Anthony Gaspipe Casso. I want to do this story for a number of reasons. But most importantly, I've noticed over the last couple of years, every time I look at the search engine words and the number of page visits on my website, the most commonly used words are Gaspipe Casso, and the most visited single page over the long haul is a really short written blog piece I did on him a couple of years ago. It's kind of strange, so I thought, well, I guess a lot of people are interested in Anthony Gaspipe Casso, and it seems to they must be able to find my website. I thought, well, I'll just maybe do a show on him. And he is a pretty interesting guy. You know, I've kind of focused a lot on the Midwest Mafia, Chicago, and of course, because of Kansas City. I'm not sure why I get so many hits on that page, but this propelled me to do research on Mr. Casso, and I'm glad I did. He was one bad dude. I guess he's still alive. In my show notes on my website, you'll find a link to a really interesting little clip where Ed Bradley from 60 Minutes interviews this guy while he was in a witness protection facility for a while. I think maybe they kicked him out. But anyhow, let's talk about Anthony Gaspipe Casso. I have always focused a lot on Chicago and Kansas City and Las Vegas and these kinds of things out west. I've not done a lot. We interviewed Andrew DiDonato from back east. I did the story, the interview of David Shanks, the policeman that worked the Cuban mafia drug operation out of Florida that went all up to the east coast, up New Jersey and all that. But I haven't done a lot about anybody in the five families. I'm going to start doing a little more of that. Probably have expanded about all I can expand for sure in Kansas City. But anyhow, let's get on with the story of Anthony Gaspipe Casso. He was born May 21st, 1940. That makes him about 5 years older than me. He would become the formal underboss of the Lucchese crime family and later on the temporary boss before he actually went in the witness protection program. Along his life's path, Gaspipe Casso gained the reputation of being a homicidal maniac. Now that's the kind of a reputation that a mob guy needs to have, I guess, in a way. Harry Alleman, we did a series on Harry Alleman. He didn't have the reputation of being a homicidal maniac, but he had the reputation of a stone-cold killer. To me, that would be better. To have the reputation of a stone-cold killer would do what had to be done when it had to be done. The homicidal maniac, I don't know, I guess you get a lot more done by having that feared reputation. But I always found it's better to get, I can get more honey with fly. I can get more flies with honey than I can with vinegar. For me, that's just my personality. So I always dealt with people trying to make informants and get people to tell me stuff that they didn't really want to talk about. Be nice to them, treat them with respect and dignity, find something that they want and try to provide that, and see if I can't get something back in return. Anthony Casso was born in Brooklyn. He was the youngest of three children, Michael and Margaret Cassio. And actually, the original name from Italy was Cusiello. They came from Campania, Italy, which is in the Naples area. He was not of Sicilian extraction. They came over here between 1896 and 1898. His father, Michael, was a dock worker in Brooklyn. He was also an enforcer for one of the local mafia outfits that controlled the docks in Brooklyn. Think of the movie On the Waterfront. His parents, Michael and Margaret ask a local capo in the Genovese family, Salvatore Calambrano, to be little Anthony Casso's godfather. Now, they had probably had a double reason for this. They wanted to have a closer connection to the Genovese family, I would say, more than anything. Maybe he was a good godfather. He probably would be able to look out for the kid. That in that subculture, being a godfather, people take that real seriously. In the subculture I came from, I don't even think we had godfathers in the Presbyterian Church in that little slice of Northwest Missouri where I come from. But I noticed that I married a Catholic. My first wife was a Catholic, and I noticed that it was pretty important to name a godfather. It was always usually an uncle. Sometimes it would be somebody outside the family. Mainly it would be an uncle who would be the godfather. And they kind of took that seriously over the years. I would imagine for Anthony Casso's father, Michael, that this was a pretty important business connection that he could make to getting closer to a capo in the Genovese family. Anthony Casso dropped out of school at age 16. Surprise, surprise, huh? He got a job alongside his father as a longshoreman on the Brooklyn docks. As a young boy, Anthony became a crack shot. You think about living in Brooklyn and in New York where you can't really get out in the country and go shoot guns. They would set up targets on rooftops, and he and his friends set up a regular shooting range. He was known as one of the best shots in the neighborhood. And he could make money shooting hawks for pigeon tenders. I guess hawks would dive bomb on those pigeons that pigeon tenders have in the tenements and the high-rises in New York City and kill off their best pigeons. Over the years, there's been a variety of stories of how Anthony Casso got the nickname Gas Pipe. Casso himself would claim it came from his father, Michael, who was a mob enforcer, and he would threaten union dissidents for the Genovese crime family. Some others would claim that he got it because he used to help his father hook up illegal gas connections for people. You know, if you get your gas or your electricity shut off, and I know we had this in Kansas City, you get somebody that knows what they're doing, they'll just go in and tap back in around the meter and get your gas or your electricity going. And I guess his father had a little side business, a little gig work doing, setting up illegal gas connections. And, you know, I would say, in my opinion, that's probably what it was from, was the fact that father and son used to go out and hook up these illegal gas connections because they were definitely messing with gas pipes. Gas Pipe Casso never really liked that nickname, and we've had discussions around here before about these nicknames and who gives it to them, whether it's the press or the police. And even then, like Anthony Spilotro, people called him Ant, and then this FBI agent Bill Romer called him the little piss ant, and the press picked up on it and always wanted to call him Ant, and he was a short guy. But Ant, in that subculture, shall we say, among Italian people, if somebody's named Anthony, if they don't start calling him Tony, and then maybe they don't because there's so many other Tonys around, they might call him Ant. But few people, and then only cops, would ever call him Gas Pipe to his face, although it was said that some of his close friends might call him Gas. That's like I've got a guy I know whose last name is Gasman, and a lot of people shorten that to Gas. Now, Gas is not a bad nickname. I can see not really wanting to be called Gas Pipe, especially if you knew it was because you and your father used to mess with gas pipes, hooking up illegal gas connections. He would rather be known as Gas Pipe Casso because he used to beat people up with a gas pipe, or his father did, one of the two. Like most mob guys, by his early 20s, he got married. His wife's name was Lillian Del Duca, and they would have a daughter and a son. Now, Gas Pipe Casso, it looks like he probably made his bones in the early 1970s. It might have been before that, but one of the earlier things I could find why he murdered a drug dealer in the neighborhood who was suspected of being a stoolie. He advanced pretty rapidly in his early 20s, later 20s. By 1974, it's reported that the Lucchese family made him a full-fledged made man, or a member of the Lucchese crime family. He must have been making money for him pretty good at a young age. Gaspipe partnered with another young Lucchese family soldier named Vittorio Amuso. They started a criminal partnership that would last basically the rest of their lives. These two guys committed scores of crimes, got into drug trafficking, burglary, and murder. Later in life, Gaspipe himself will claim that he was one of the greatest burglars ever known. He claims in that 60 Minutes interview that he was an expert with a magnesium burning bar. He could open heavy safes and bank vaults. He also claims that the character played by James Caan in Thief was based on him and his exploits. If you saw that movie Thief, and if you haven't, I recommend you go see it. James Caan rigged up a magnesium burning bar to go into a safe, and it's quite a dramatic scene when he's using that magnesium burning bar. I mean, it burns hot. I know a guy here in Kansas City that alleges to me he was the first guy to use burning bars back in the 60s on safes, and he went all over the Midwest doing safe jobs. I don't really agree with Gaspipe that they based James Caan on him, or that little crew of James Caan and Jim Belushi, I don't remember their names in the movie, were based on his crew, because that crew was really based in Chicago. The movie was set in Chicago, and they had a real deal Chicago burglar, a Chicago outfit burglar, as a technical advisor, and had a small part in that film, but who actually went on to get a part in the kind of a spinoff from that film with Dennis Farina. Gaspipe's first capo in the Lucchese family was a man named Christopher Funari. I think they called him Tick. This man would go on to become a consigliere in the Lucchese crime family, which increased Gaspipe Casso's stature in the crime family. He was assigned to a man named Vincent Vinnie Beans Fossari. That's a good nickname, Vinnie Beans. We used to have a guy here called Beans Inzarello. He was he stole from truck lines and docks and things like that. They operated out of a couple of different storefronts, social clubs, probably 116th Street in Manhattan and then 14th Avenue in Brooklyn. Gaspipe Casso also got close to another rising star in the Lucchese family, a man named Victor Amuso, which we mentioned before. They committed scores of crimes. When Tick Funari became the Lucchese consigliere, he asked Casso to take over the 19th hole crew. Casso declined. He didn't really want to do that. He suggested his good friend Vittorio Amuso be promoted to take over that crew instead, and he asked to be Funari's aide. A consigliere at that time was allowed to have one soldier work for him directly in the family. It'd be the guy that drove him around and always acted as his backup and would be part of the decision-making process. As a consigliere was giving advice, then he would be able to sit at that table and be right there. And it was kind of like being the boss's driver in many cities. You'd get promoted enough to be the boss's driver, you're in on so much stuff, you're not really relegated to a small slice of the entire family business. How much money you make, you're going to get a little piece of the action. You may not make as much money if you were a crew leader, but you don't know anything outside of what your crew's doing. If you're a driver to one of these guys, you know everything that's going on, which will make you much more important and give you much more stature in that world. And a lot of those working guys, the guys that are down on the streets, it's just like on the police department. Guys want to be tack guys. They want to be SWAT team members, or they want to be a robbery detective or a homicide detective. They want to be an intelligence unit detective. They want to be down where the rubber meets the road, where the action is. They don't really want to get into to being a captain or a major, and where you have to ponder all the decisions and figure out the best way to go and have to deal with outside influences, shall we say. And I would say that Casso probably, he wanted to move on up and be part of that larger decision-making process rather than the guy down on the streets, although he was not afraid of the streets, as we'll find out. During this time, this is when he got his reputation as a raving lunatic. He would get involved with a very lucrative drug dealing, I think it was a large-scale marijuana business with Roy DeMeo of the Gambino crime family. He had his burglary crew going. He set up burglaries, and they'd go do it, or he'd go along with them because he was the burning bar guy. Gaspipe Casso was a guy that knew the cops were out there, knew the feds were out there, and he worked extra hard to avoid any attention from them. If he had a meeting, he was known to have them in really loud places. He was really cognizant of the of a hidden microphone and try to sit near a jukebox and turn it up in a bar. And believe me, I've got a few wiretaps where they've got music going in the barn, and it is really tough to make out the conversation with that jukebox going in the background. But if you're looking at somebody face to face, you can see their lips moving, you can see their body language, and you may not be able to hear exactly every word, but each person knows what they're talking about. But boy, somebody just listening to it through a microphone, you don't have any idea what they're talking about. Gaspipe also knew the advantages to having sources within law enforcement. In New York City, not so hard to do. You could find guys who are willing to take some money. So he kept a number of detectives and patrolmen, maybe even a sergeant or two, on a regular payroll during this time. And that won't come back to bite him, but we've got two guys that we're going to talk about in a little bit that it's just amazing the relationship he had with these two, the mob cops, they end up being called. Now, in the 1980s, Gaspipe Caso got caught up in a violent clash within the Gambino crime family. If you remember, John Gotti had Paul Castellano, the boss, killed so he could move on up and be the boss of the Gambino crime family. In 1986, he helped set up a plot to use a bomb and blow up Gotti. They ended up killing a Gotti associate or underboss named Frankie DeCiccio in a car bombing. Now, as Lucchese, at this point in time, the Lucchese crime family boss was Anthony Carallo. He was going to get found guilty in a racketeering trial. He picked Gaspipe Caso as a new Lucchese boss. And once again, which I find interesting, he turned down that offer and wanted to be more like a power behind the throne and suggested again his friend Vittorio Amuso become the new boss, and then he becomes Amuso's consigliere. It's really funny, I never wanted a position of responsibility in the family. He really wanted to be the guy that sat back. I think it also gave him the option of running his own scores, running his own little crew off on the side, but being part of the overall decision-making. I don't know. What do you guys think? It's kind of interesting why he would not want to move on up and be boss. Although I know in other cities, they've not wanted. In Chicago, it's almost like they played musical chairs with the boss, who's the boss, whether it was Sam Giancana or Joey Aupa or Anthony Accardo or Paul Rica. They know that the boss draws the attention of the cops. So, you know, you want a boss who's not doing very much, and then you need a guy under the boss, as in here in Kansas City, doesn't get as much attention, who's out doing things. And Gaspipe Caso, he wanted to be the guy away from the boss, out doing stuff, I got a feeling. And by this time, he was really doing well. He will do well his whole life. He had an expensive apartment. He had a cargo jet to help out with his marijuana distributions and all the other toys, and live the lifestyle of a very wealthy man. Shortly after the DeCiccio hit, you remember the John Gotti underboss that got killed in a bombing, a hit team of three men ambushed Gaspipe Caso outside a Long Island restaurant. Had been stalking for quite a while, and they finally caught him alone in his Lincoln as he was getting ready to either go in or just coming out of this restaurant. One man, who would later be determined to be a Peckerwood, actually a non-Italian dude, maybe he was half Italian, I didn't really research him that much. He was a mafia associate for sure. James Heidel jumped out of the hit team's car, shot a 12-gauge shotgun into Gaspipe's car, probably had five rounds, four in the magazine and one in the chamber, more than likely is where those shotguns are. Anyhow, Gaspipe was able to exit the car, roll out of the car door on the opposite side, and get away and get on the inside, and these guys ran off. Well, much to their dismay, Gaspipe survived this hit. And I mentioned before his connections with New York City police officers. And by this time, he was closely associated with two New York City police officers, one named Louis Eppolito and the other one Stephen Caracappa. Because when they were exposed, it was learned that these cops did more work for the New York Mafia than they did for the New York City Police Department. And that included doing hits, doing actual murders for them. Gaspipe learned that the guy with the shotgun was this James Heidel. He paid these mob cops to find Heidel and make him believe that he was being arrested. Once they got him inside their police car, they didn't go. He thought he was going to the station. Well, they took him to some kind of a garage and bound and gagged him and threw him back into the trunk of another car and delivered Heidel to a safe house that Gaspipe had set up. He either owned it or he had control of it, probably a safe house that they just kept. And they left him there with him kicking and screaming and beating up against that truck, I understand. Gaspipe would get Heidel out and beat and torture him, shoot him in the various limbs, like shoot him in his knees and his arms and his hands and things like that. And finally, he did learn that a man named Edward Leno was also part of the hit team. And he would then pay Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa some money just to go kill this Edward Leno. By 1989, Gaspipe Casso became the Lucchese underboss, replacing Mariano Macaluso. By 1989, Gaspipe Casso became the Lucchese underboss, moving up from Consigliera, and he replaced Mariano Macaluso, who had since retired. His old friend Vittorio Amuso had become the boss, as we've mentioned before, but they say Gaspipe wielded as much influence as Amuso did over the Lucchese crime family. Casso was maintaining a very expensive, high-profile lifestyle. He wore the most fashionable clothes and most expensive jewelry. One story I read claims that he had a diamond ring he would wear around worth $500,000. Now, I find that hard to believe, but maybe he did. He bought a mansion. He lived the Godfather lifestyle. He bought a mansion in a really upscale Brooklyn neighborhood. Did not want to leave Brooklyn, apparently. He was known for going on huge spending sprees and taking people along with him. How he financed this was he and his buddy and partner, Victor Amuso, were sharing in the profits from the entire Lucchese family illegal activities, besides their own little pieces of action they had going on. Reportedly, Long Island trucking companies were giving in to extortion to keep labor peace down and keep their trucks from being damaged, much as up to $15,000 to $20,000 every month for the Casey family. They probably had to share some of that with their guys on down the road who would be the ones they would send out to damage the trucks or steal from the trucks or whatever, but they kept the most of that, and that's just the beginning. They had a kickback scheme going from 8 air freight carriers getting $75,000 a month. They guaranteed labor peace and minimal union benefits for their workers. They had control of the unions that the air freight carriers were dealing with. They had profits coming in from a string of video poker machines throughout Brooklyn, maybe throughout all the city, at least throughout their own area that the Lucchese family controlled. There was a concrete company named the Quadrazzo Concrete Company, and government would later learn that they'd been paying them as much as $200,000 every year to keep, problems down with the union, to not have problems on the jobs, and to use political influence to help them get contracts and construction jobs. They also had rackets involving garment district unions and the employers, the garment factory workers. It's claimed they got as much as $200,000 a year from this. I'm not sure about all these figures, but that is a lot of money. But they were doing well, shall we say. And there's one really notable score that they helped set up. They helped members of the Colombo family take steel from a construction site that was on the West Side Highway in Manhattan, and this supposedly earned them about another $500,000, $500,000. They helped the Gambino crime family when they set up a Lucchese family protected contractor who was building a housing complex project in Coney Island, and they got $600,000 from the Gambino crime family for turning that over for the Lucchese family, turning that little piece of action over to them. It kind of sounds like a lot of that stuff in The Sopranos, and always having these Johnny Sack and doing the construction projects and getting the construction money and how much was he going to share. Art ripped from real life, but this is real life. Okay, I see we're up around 30 minutes or so. I think we will make this into a two-parter. Anthony Casso was an interesting guy. He was a raving maniac. He was much feared mob boss in the greater New York City area, I think, including by his fellow mobsters as well as by the construction workers, the construction unions, the construction company owners, probably had some dealings with Donald Trump putting up towers in Manhattan and doing things like that. Next week, we'll get into a little more about him, about how he got involved with the Russian mob. You know, the Russian mob has kind of taken up the vacuum where some of the Italian mobs are going down. People are going into legitimate business. People, their kids are not going back into the family business, shall we say, and going to become lawyers and doctors and other kind of people moving out to the suburbs. Gaspipe will continue to operate throughout the 90s, in which there was many, many murders going on, and this whole John Gotti, Lucchese, Gambino crime family war. I think I need to do my public service announcement now. If you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Now, don't forget, folks, to go on my website. You can get my movie and get the DVD. Now, you can rent my DVD, Gangland Wire, and learn really the backstory behind the movie Casino by going to Amazon, and you can rent it for $1.99. But you ought to go to my website, help out the podcast a little bit here, and go to my website and buy it for, $14.95, I think, plus shipping. On the DVD, I have three extra features on it that you're not going to get in the just by streaming the movie. I also have the Kansas City Mob Tour app. If you want to take your own mob tour of Kansas City, go to the iTunes App Store and download that. You can't get it on for an Android phone, I'm sorry to say. I had a little problem with Google, which I can't figure out, and they won't talk to me about. I have a book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. It really examines at depth the FBI investigation into skimming from Las Vegas and how they made the case. Because as you may know or may not know, I was able to obtain copies of the transcripts and the audio from all the wiretaps that the government put in as evidence in the what we call the straw man casino cases. If you get the Kindle version, which I highly recommend, I don't make as much money, but you get the Kindle version, you can get. I have links to the actual audio. You'll find the transcripts and then click on the transcripts in the Kindle book, and it'll go to the actual links. You'll be able to hear the men who actually were saying the words, along with captions on it, so you can understand what they're saying, because they're a little bit hard to understand. Wiretaps are always hard to understand without reading along what they're actually saying and without any explanation. Okay, good night, folks.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.
Probably had five rounds, one in the chamber and four in the...